each part of growing up supports us in standing up and even surviving the next challenge or trauma, both personally and collectively. Dr. David Bruselli, founder and CEO of Trauma Recovery Services, travels the world, oftentimes to those places most traumatized by war, bringing a piece of solid ground that we all share to stand firm during times of duress. We're all wired that way. He's just reminding us that with these concrete tools, we can translate our trauma into compassion for self and others. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned for part two. This is Tributaries.
But when I have a client and they say, okay, here's the story of where the trauma occurred. Here's the injury. I tell them, that's fine. We want to keep the injury in mind, but I don't want their body and their mind regressing back to the time of the injury, because if it does, they will actually recreate the same neurophysiological injury that they had at the time of the event. But what I need is for their body and their neural pattern, or their body and their brain, to stay in the present moment, because now they have mechanisms and greater strength and resiliency of the present moment body, which is going to bring them through the recovery process. If they simply regress into the past, they can actually regress into the same neurophysiological state of the injury of the past and lose their capacity for healing. So we have to keep them in the present moment. Even though they may be recalling the past, we don't want them getting lost in the past. Like you said, with this oversympathetic questioning about, oh, tell me about the injury and I'm so sorry it happened. When you do that, oftentimes they will regress back into the past and lose their capacity for healing.
David, I know you work culturally with religions and their relationship with ethnicity and politics. Do you familiarize yourself with an area's folklore? Is trauma written into a culture, and is that a good thing or a restrictive thing?
Well, if you're talking about stress and trauma, what we're looking at is every culture has a way to include it in their cultural belief or in their belief system, if you will. So that means everything from religion to normal everyday life. I like to know, how do they take up the concept of stress or anxiety or trauma in their life? What place does it have? And what mechanisms have they already put in place in their society and their culture to understand this in life? Because every society has death in it. Death means that we've lived through some sort of trauma and we survive. But every society envisions this within their cultural and religious beliefs in a certain way. So I want to know, within that whole structure of their belief system in society, do they have any mechanisms that they already have in place that help them endure, survive, and evolve from these traumatic events in their lives? Because all of us do. We all have a belief system in which we have sort of envisioned our life story. How is life and how do we deal with life? So it's good to know it, simply because I can embed my training or my exercises within their belief system, so it helps them make greater sense of it, and they see that there's a place for this right within their religious or their context of belief. And that's very helpful for them, so that they don't see it as something foreign. So as an example, when I went to China and I was teaching at the Chinese Institute these exercises, at the end, the Chinese teachers that I was training to do this sat up and said, oh, we see what you've done. You've taken our traditional understanding of qi energy, which is what they called it. You westernized an access to qi energy, and you brought it back to us in your new form. But see, they already had an understanding of what I was doing. They simply placed it into their belief system, qi, and then they were able to accept it. And they said, this is great. It's a new form or a new way to access qi energy. And they were delighted by it because they had a context they could put it in.
Did they feel like it was better, or because it was a new or modernized version, having come out of different times, that it could be perhaps more applicable?
What they saw was an easier access route to discharging overstimulated chi. They saw it as the Western way of doing it, and they told me they're going to continue to teach it to their patients because they thought it was just as advantageous as the work that they did by using acupuncture, as an example, or herbal medicines. And they said, oh, great, this is another form to down or to discharge overstimulated chi. So they didn't see it as better or worse than theirs. They saw it as another way.
Moving into perhaps a more esoteric realm, I'm wondering, are you seeing pieces of religion, for instance, that meld well with culture or ethnicity? Or do you see these various boxes really sort of butting up against each other, really creating trauma for different societies or the world coming together when different ideologies are held?
Well, when you're talking about that realm of belief systems, you're talking about two different things. One would be what we would call traditional religion, and the other one would be what we call maybe the mystical realm, or the realm where you open your consciousness without any preference to religious ideation or ceremonies or symbols or whatever, religious practices. When we stay in religious practices, we usually get stuck there because so much of that has to do with ego, about you have to believe my belief system, you have to believe in my God or my higher power, you have to perform my rites and my rituals, or you're not truly in the spiritual realm. And so that's where we get into the fights and the arguments, because Muslims, Christians, Jews, Hindus, Buddhists would all suggest, well, you have to do these rituals, you have to follow these rites of passage, you have to believe in this book or these dogmas. And then that's where we get into the arguments. When you stay in the realm of what we call mystical realm, and all of these major religious belief systems have a mystical realm, interestingly enough, but when they stay in that mystical realm, they just say, well, you just have to have a higher consciousness. And you can use my God's name, or you could use my rituals or any rituals. But the important thing is that these rituals and these ceremonies are for the purpose of expanding your consciousness, or you're opening your heart, or those types of things. So the mystical people would say, well, this is about opening your heart. And whatever way you open your heart, as long as you open it, you've been successful. So it doesn't matter what ritual or what ceremony you followed, what book you believed in. If it opened your heart, that was the goal of it. And so when you're talking about that realm, I'm talking about it as well. I'm saying we have to move to the realm where human consciousness and our heart is open to the point where we have what I would call compassion to humanity, meaning it doesn't matter what religion I am. I go around the world and I work with all religious belief systems, and I'm looking for people to take traumas and allow the traumas to heal in them, so that their heart opens to compassion, and that compassion is not restricted. Compassion is expanded to all human beings, actually all species, living species on the planet, so that we embrace animals, we embrace plants, we embrace humans, we embrace our people suffering, and how do we help ease them or bring them out of their suffering so all human beings can go to the depth of compassion towards human suffering on the planet.
Uh-huh.
That, I believe, is the ultimate goal of our humanity, is to be compassionate to everybody and not restrict people from our human compassion because a religious belief system or a dogma weeds out those people who we believe are right and are wrong. We must ultimately have compassion for all human beings.
So you've turned Mission Impossible into a very secret mission.
Right, exactly.
With a smile.
Exactly.
You've certainly put yourself into some quite hazardous places and situations. Can you share an experience of that and give a specific example of how your work was able to shift a situation?
Yeah. Well, one example was when I was living in the Palestinian West Bank, and in Israel. I had two homes, and I was moving back and forth between those two. And so I saw the tremendous suffering of the Israelis, and I saw the tremendous suffering of the Palestinians. And what was interesting was that each side wanted me to choose their side. See, so the Israelis wanted me to sort of identify with them and say, look at the suffering they're going through under the hands of Palestinians. And the Palestinians wanted me to embrace their suffering and say, look at the suffering we go under the hand of the Israelis. And I did realize that both sides were suffering. But what I also realized was that choosing a side was exactly the wrong thing to do, because everybody had already chosen sides. And so that would mean I would prefer one side and see their suffering more difficult as to the other side. And I realized that if I was supposed to be compassionate to all human beings, choosing a side was exactly the wrong thing to do, that I had to keep my heart open and recognize compassionately the suffering of both sides. And that was very, very difficult to do, because when I was living in the Palestinian West Bank, and when there was some sort of domination and violence that was being inflicted on the Palestinians by the Israelis, I wanted to just get angry and hate the Israelis. Then when I moved over to the Israeli side and I saw pain being inflicted by Palestinians, I wanted to get angry and hate Palestinians. And I realized that was a natural human behavior to want to do that. It was a natural defensive mechanism to see the other side as the enemy and therefore hate them and therefore project my defense mechanisms towards them. And then one time I was at an Israeli checkpoint and I was watching the Israeli soldier who was about 22 years old and a Palestinian woman who was about the same age. Now, she was trying to take her child from the West Bank into Israel, into Jerusalem, to actually have her child checked at the hospital because the child was sick. And when I watched this Israeli soldier, I could see in his face he was not allowed to let this Palestinian woman through because the checkpoint was, there was a closure at the time. He wasn't allowed to let her through. And you could see the sadness in his face because he wanted to, but he had a mandate that he wasn't allowed to. You could also see the sadness on the woman's face and the fear because she was afraid for her child's health, but she knew also that this soldier couldn't let her through the checkpoint. And I watched both of them stand there and cry. Now, the soldier obviously held back his tears, but it was very, very apparent that if he had the authority, he would definitely let her through because he could see she wasn't a threat. He could see that she was terribly threatened and frightened of her child's health, and that humanly wise, he would have let her through for the sake of compassion. Both of them stood there compassionately in pain for each other's position. Eventually, he was never allowed to let her through, but I watched this amazing moment of history where you could see that rules and regulations and laws and religions had completely prevented them from being compassionate towards each other. Yet they felt compassion, they just weren't allowed to act on it. And it was an amazing lesson for me to recognize rules, laws, regulations, wars, violence, religions, they completely undermine our ability to respond to each other compassionately. And yet, if we did respond in a compassionate manner, we would bring a tremendous amount of healing on this planet in every level, rules, laws, regulations, wars, and religions. So I saw humanity exposed at its most bare moment. And I realize we still are compassionate beings. We've just created institutions that prevent us from acting on that compassion.
And yes, and I feel like I need to hold, and I would assume or suggest that you might as well, that that moment in time that did really expose humanity, even though they couldn't act on it, that was a step in making the shift.
Was it expose that rawness of humanity, irregardless of how much we've repressed it by our own institutions.
Right.
We still have it at our very deepest core. We still have it. And that's, I believe, what true healing is when we go to that deepest core of ourselves and we now live from a place of compassion, human compassion, towards each other's suffering.
I can tell from what you've been doing and the places where you've been and the circumstances you've placed yourself in is different than someone who might be broadsided by a trauma and you very knowingly are walking into it. I think you can do that because of everything you've seen and what you know you're consciously doing. You really are handling it from a whole other part of the brain.
Right. Well, what has happened is that once I learned how to live in war and live in political violence or live in natural disasters, because I go to disaster zones a lot around on the planet, I've begun to go underneath cultures and societies and psychology, and I recognize this is simply the human organism simply trying to survive whatever it has been forced to go through. So if it's a natural disaster or it's political violence, we're all simply genetically encoded to try to survive whatever circumstances we see ourselves in. So what I've done is try to say, okay, I understand the circumstances you've been in. It's been political violence or it's been a natural disaster. But let's go back to a neurophysiological level where you're genetically encoded not only to survive this event, which they have done, but actually to evolve and learn from this event. Because it's through these types of events that we actually evolve as a species. We learn lessons because of traumatic events. And if you talk to a lot of people, they'll tell you, even though that trauma was horrible and I hated it and I never wanted it to happen, since that time, my life has completely changed. And what they usually then describe is I've become more resilient or I've become more compassionate towards other people who suffer from that same type of trauma or natural disaster. So there's something in the human species itself, that we can not only take that experience that we survived, but we can actually learn from it and evolve in some way as a human species because of that experience, not despite the experience. So traumas on the planet or stresses that we experience in our lives have the potential of actually helping us become better or more evolved human beings. And so every time I go to natural disaster zones or war zones, I take it up as, okay, how do we take this experience and how do we learn from it and then use it as a way of evolving within ourselves to become more compassionate towards ourselves and eventually more compassionate towards others?
As you're talking about the evolution, we began in the initial primitive brain and the fight or flight response. And before we started this interview, you said, oh, well, what about quantum physics? So how does this evolving work into what you see going on with quantum physics?
Well, when you talk about the realm of quantum physics, what you're basically saying is that instead of seeing ourselves as matter, you know, as muscle, tissue, bone, etc., we also have vibration in us. We're vibrational beings. So quantum physics is below the level of atoms. It's subatomic. And it says basically that all things that we see, whether they're innate or they're live beings, are vibrational frequencies. So we're nothing but vibration. So here would be the theory behind quantum physics. If I'm a vibrating organism and I have contraction patterns in my muscle tissue as a defense mechanism, the fight or flight response, and they're still locked in my body because I haven't released these traumas, I haven't resolved them, that muscle tissue that's contracted is giving a different vibrational frequency than when I heal the trauma, I let go of the contractions in my muscles, and I take a deep breath, my diaphragm releases, and I feel like I'm living in a relaxed state. Well, a relaxed organism, human organism, gives off a different vibrational frequency than a contracted one. And the way we know that in our society is if you walk into a room and there was a death, you walk into the room and you could feel there's like what we call heavy energy. And all of a sudden your body picks up this frequency of heavy energy. And you can become depressed or go through some crying or sadness, even though you don't know the person. But you're crying because the person that you do know is going through sadness. The opposite can happen too. You can go into a room where there's a party and everybody's energy is light and excited and happy, and you walk in and you start to feel light and excited and happy. It's because the vibrational frequency of the room affected your vibrational frequency. So let's take this into trauma. If I've healed traumas in me, does that mean my vibrational frequency has changed? And if I come to you and you're now going through a trauma, can the vibrational frequency of my body help you shift from a trauma vibrational frequency into a more healed vibrational frequency? And the implication of that is that if 10 of us who have been through trauma heal our traumas and we shift our vibrational frequency, can we be emissaries, if you will, for other people who are going through trauma and help them heal their vibrational frequency just by being in their presence? So can we help people heal just by doing our own healing work inside ourselves?
And the answer, of course, is yes.
For me, it is, because I do go into traumas and natural disaster zones. And what I believe my whole job is to not let myself lose my vibrational frequency of healing, but to bring that vibrational frequency into the community that is suffering and having trouble coming to that place of healing within themselves.
Exactly.
If I can do that, can I be an emissary to help people heal from traumas on the planet?
Be the party.
Exactly. Exactly right. And I believe we all do that already. We're just talking about it from a level of quantum physics.
Right, and that is a good focus to have. You know, you just spoke about going into the place where there's just been a death. You have a choice. You can either join them in their vibration or hold on to your own and bring it with you and perhaps raise them up even just a tad, you know.
Right, and see, we already have this in our society. As a parent or as an adult, if a child injures themselves and they become disturbed and frightened and anxious because they're bleeding, what do? We stay in a calm place for what? For the sake of calming down the child. What does that mean? It means I don't get excited and go through anxiety and nervousness. I don't start to collapse and cry at the same level of the child's frequency. I hold an adult calming, caring frequency so the child could pick that up and realize they can come out of their anxiety because they have a parent who's calming them down. And so we actually invite that child into the calm state if they're in an anxious state.
I know, referring back to that incident with my daughter when she had that accident, at one point one of the parents said, well, how are you? How are you holding up through this? And literally what came out of my mouth without even thinking was, I think I've been in shock since my first daughter was born, which had been about 20-some years before.
Right, exactly. And see, there's the whole point. The parent's role, and we do this quite frequently and quite well, the parent's role is to stay in a place of calmness. And this is harder, obviously, when the injury is more severe with the child. But even if a child falls on the cement and bangs its head and, it needs stitches, what the parent will do is try to stay calm and relaxed, get the child to the emergency room, whatever, get them stitches, bring them back home, hold the child if need be, help them calm down, help them reduce their anxiety. Then when the child gets put to bed, the parent may go into their own bedroom and collapse and cry, etc., and resolve their own trauma of this. But what they do for the sake of the child is to try to hold a place of calmness and groundedness so the child can pick up on that and not stay in their state of anxiety and fear.
Yeah. You know, I have another experience I want to share with you, because I'm sure I haven't necessarily seen all the pieces of this, but my mother was English and she was living over there when all the bombing was going on. And when my town had their first air raid signal happen, I didn't even really necessarily know what it was about, but I was at the library, and when I heard that, every cell in my body totally freaked out, and I ran home at a speed that might have broken some land speed record
right.
At age 8 or whatever it was. And years later, through all of my experience and learning, I realized that there was complete cellular memory going on that was passed on from my mother to me.
Well, we actually already know that we genetically pass on our learnings and trainings.
Yes.
So that we're passing on our resiliency, basically. but also there's what we call cultural trauma, where we are actually trained how to live in a traumatized state because it's reflected in the whole culture. So when you hear an air raid drill, everybody reflects back to you fear, danger, running, hiding, etc., and you learn that behavior. Now, that's a survival behavior that we need to learn if there is a bombing, and we need to react when there's an air raid drill, etc. But when that's passed on, you could be sitting, this happened to me when I came back from a war, I'm sitting in Washington, D.C. during the 4th of July celebration, and every single firework was activating in me a fight-or-flight response. I actually had a horrible time. It was anxiety-ridden. I was in terror, even though I was looking at the pretty lights, and even though consciously I knew they were fireworks and I was not in danger, that did not stop the neurophysiology from activating over and over and over because that pattern was still in me to protect yourself when you hear a loud explosion.
Well, David, this has been very wonderful speaking with you today, and I'd like to remind everyone that your book is The Revolutionary Trauma Release Process, and what is your website?
My website is traumaprevention.com.
David Berselli, thank you very much for being a huge reminder to be the party. Bring it.
Thank you very much, Robin. I really appreciate it. It was a very nice discussion.
Many thanks to David Berselli for his wonderful work in our world. For any guest information, to listen to archives and share resources, it's tributariesradio.org. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.